Environmental success stories are favorites here at Living on Earth. So we were excited to read a new book called Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. One of the book's co-authors and photographer is Boston Globe editor and columnist Derek Jackson.
It's pretty funny for me because I started off as a sports writer, and so once upon a time, the only birds I knew about were the Atlanta Hawks, the Philadelphia Eagles, and the St. Louis Cardinals and Baltimore Orioles. But because my wife's an outdoor person, I got into the outdoors and I heard about these puffins. And at that time, the success of it was only 5 years old. So it was still pretty exciting to be on a place where life that had been lost had been restored.
That restoration was the work of the book's other co-author, Steve Kress. Steve is the vice president of the National Audubon Society, and since his early 20s, he has been working to restore the historic puffin population to Egg Rock off the coast of northern Maine. Steve says his devotion to the puffin was rooted in a childhood spent close to the birds and bees.
As a kid, I was fortunate in meeting ornithologists and other birders, and they shared their passion and their enthusiasm with me. And I caught the bug of just enjoying being out in nature. Started with non-birds. It started with lizards, actually. The blue-tailed skink was my greatest of prizes as a child. But any frog or turtle or reptile, anything I could actually get my hands on was terrifically interesting. So, yeah, that's how it all started. And then it just sort of stuck from there. And I just kept meeting more people and realizing a relatively small world of birders out there. There's so much interconnection. And all pathways sort of pointed me toward Hog Island, which is sort of where ornithology had its beginning in the northeastern United States.
How's that?
Well, there's this beautiful island, a 330-acre pristine island, spruce-covered island offshore near Damariscotta, Maine, where Roger Torrey Peterson, the sort of undisputed father of birding in the United States, was the first bird instructor. Alan Cruikshank, another famed early American birder, and others have followed. And they've just sort of started a tradition of people coming there and learning about birds. I started working at the Audubon Camp in Maine in 1969 and learned that puffins once bred about 8 miles from where I was working on Hog Island. And once I discovered that those islands were once home to puffins, I couldn't see them the same as I used to. I saw them as places that were devoid of life rather than full of life. It was a strange twist of perspective. But once I realized that they were a diminished place, I began setting out to try to bring them back. I didn't know that I would be at this for decades. When I started this, I thought, oh, this is just going to take a few years and then I'll be on to something else. But it hasn't worked out that way.
I guess not. So what made you think that you could restore these puffins to the places that they had been hunted off, almost a century before?
The idea of bringing the puffins back probably was influenced by other bird conservation projects at the time. Notably, the Peregrine Fund was starting its work at Cornell, trying to reestablish the peregrine falcon, a bird that had disappeared because of the use of DDT. It was still a novel idea, and many people at the time felt that it was better just to let nature take its course, and the species that were best adapted to living with humanity would be the ones that would be the future co-inhabitants of the planet, and if we lose some along the way, they were the ones that just didn't fit anymore.
And I suppose this philosophy struck you with, let's see, who cohabits with people best? Roaches, rats, things that we don't particularly like.
So I've come to realize that the species that benefit the most from people tend to be scavengers. And yes, the species that seem to do the best often are considered nuisance species by people. In the bird world, that would include lots of native birds. Not just introduced species, but natives like gulls, herring, and blackback gulls were the most obvious example of that along the Maine coast, scavenging behind fishing boats and garbage dumps. So if that was the pattern, then we were going to lose birds like the puffins, and there was nobody out there really trying to help these specialized species, especially if they were not an endangered species. Endangered birds had a certain cachet just from their rareness, but common species, not necessarily, especially species that were still nesting in the millions, and the puffin was among those. You could find millions of them if you would just travel to Iceland. And some would say to me, why should you bother to restore a common species when people want to see them? They just should go to Iceland. And I felt like, well, we lost them on the main coast. Perhaps it was the proper thing to do to bring them back.
Now, you got to say, if you look at a puffin, it's hard not to, well, come on, laugh. They're roly-poly. They have this brightly colored beak. They stand up erect, but they kind of waddle. They almost look like a penguin. And, well, they're charming, right?
Puffins are charming birds. They kind of are caricatures of the human form. They're upright. They stroll. They waddle back and forth. And they have this comical face, clown-like face. So, yeah, they are sort of built-in endearing. Of course, it's all very functional from their point of view. Their feet are all the way to the back because they use them as rudders underwater. And they have those short wings they hold to their sides because they use them as flippers-like underwater. It's all about function. But it also happens to characterize a human clown-like form, which people love.
And you in particular. I mean, these birds sucked you right in. I mean, of all birds that you could have chosen to devote your life to, although I gather at the time you didn't realize it's going to be a lifelong exercise. I mean, are there any that are cuter than this?
I don't think there's any that are cuter than a puffin.
So you decide at age 20 that you are going to figure out a way to save these birds, to bring them back to this, to the place where they had been. How did you start?
I started the idea of bringing puffins back by learning as much as I could about them. A few things I learned was that puffins lay just one egg. They don't usually lay it until they're several years old. And the, interesting enough, at the end of the breeding cycle, which is about 6 weeks long, the chicks head off to sea by themselves, not with the parents, which was very helpful to me in my plan because there was no way I was going to be able to follow these chicks to sea. But the key part of this story was that they learned where home was while they were at the island. My hope was that I could find puffin chicks that were impressionable and that I could move them before they had learned where their hatching island was, hand rear them, release them, and give them the opportunity to learn about the release site, the new home. That method is called translocation now, and it's widely used, but at the time, it was never used before for a seabird.
So where can you get sort of, you know, extra spare baby puffins?
Fortunately, there are still large colonies of puffins in Canada, and I had to travel all the way to Great Island, Newfoundland, and with the cooperation of the Canadian Wildlife Service and with their help, we climbed down the cliffs of Great Island where there, at the time, were about 160,000 pairs of puffins. It was an awesome sight. We moved as many as 200 of them at a time.
And how do you move a baby puffin?
You pick the puffin up, take it out of its burrow, put it in a specially built carrying case, and then as fast as you can, you bring it back to Maine.
I don't imagine Ma and Pa Puffin were too thrilled about this.
Well, when you reach into a puffin burrow, you have to be careful. Because if the parent puffins are in there, that big, colorful, cuddly-looking beak is actually quite a crusher. And if they grab a hold of your finger and they start twisting and shaking with a raptor-like hook, which they have, it can be damaging. But we did it, and we reached into enough puffin burrows, and we were able to obtain enough puffins to bring them back. We tried not to revisit the same puffin burrow in more than 1 year so that we didn't have ongoing disturbance to the same pair of parent puffins. And most of the chicks survived that we brought from Newfoundland. They are very hardy little birds. And they trucked off to sea with our bands and disappeared in the darkness.
You brought hundreds of birds from Canada to Egg Rock Island where you hoped that you'd get a new puffin colony, but how would you know if you had succeeded?
The only way we would know whether we were having success was to see the puffins come back. And we put leg bands on them before they fledged, that is, before they left the island, so we would recognize them in the future. A metal band on one leg and usually a color leg band, a plastic band on the other leg, and then we just had to sit out there and wait. And the thing is that we had to wait 4 years without seeing anything at all. 4 years into the project, we had released several hundred puffins and none of them had come back. I was starting to get questions from the supporters, the providers of the puffins, and the Canadian Wildlife Service were wondering, what is going on? When are you going to have some success? I asked for patience. No one's ever done this before. We have to see this out, because if we fail at this, other people in the future probably won't want to try something similar. And there's a great need. Even then, I knew there were many rare seabirds that would benefit from this project if we could prove success.
So, big goose egg so far, or maybe big puffin egg so far, but no birds back. So, this is the point that you're about to give up, but, well, by the title of your book, obviously you didn't. What happened?
In 4 years, we needed to have some success. And so I began trying to think like a puffin. And I realized that one of the things that was missing was the fact that there were no other puffins on the island. Puffins are social birds. They nest in colonies. And a young puffin coming back, even if it did remember Egg Rock, might not come ashore without the sight of other puffins. So I came up with the idea of using decoys. So we got some decoys, specially made, specially carved, not something you can buy off the shelf anyplace. Put some in the water, put some on land, and we didn't have to wait very long before a puffin showed up. Within days, there was a puffin there, landed on the island first, and then it landed with the decoys on land, and it had our leg bands. I was so excited.
So puffins like a party, huh?
Puffins don't like to be alone. They like other puffins. Now, puffins do land with decoys, we discovered, and they'll pick at the beaks, and they'll pick at the belly, and eventually they will get bored, and they'll leave, because they're not getting much response, and they're not really fooled by the decoy for long. But I decided to put out mirrors, boxes with mirrors on all sides, and the puffins would land with the decoys, then they'd waddle up to see the reflection in the mirror, and they would just sit there and look at themselves. And they move a little bit, the reflection would move. I don't think they really were totally fooled by this to think it's another puffin. But what did happen was that other puffins would land with the puffins that were sitting among the decoys and the mirrors. And eventually we started seeing more and more puffins sitting on the island.
So you've created a puffin party by having models. That always helps a party scene. You have a mirror ball. That helps a party scene. Mm. But what about the sound?
We didn't use sound for puffins, recorded sound. Later, when I started attracting terns, I started using recorded sounds for terns, and that has proved to be very attractive for the terns. With puffins, I was trying to keep it simple, and puffins are not all that loud. They don't call a lot, especially at that stage in their lifetime. Later in life, they have a deep growling call. They sound sort of like this. That's a call between a mated pair. But the prospecting birds, these young birds, they don't call much. So we wanted to try to keep it as simple as we could. And the mirrors, the decoys, they started coming back, but they still weren't breeding. We were 8 years into this project, still no nesting.
So what do you do then? I mean, if these birds aren't propagating themselves, you're going to be bringing chicks from Canada forever.
And even a greater concern was that some of our birds that we brought from Canada started nesting on a nearby puffin colony, Matinicus Rock.
Traitors.
I was worried that they would move over there after all my efforts, so close but so far. 8 years into the project, the critics were really becoming increasingly vocal at that point that this had not worked. Stop spending money on it. Stop saying that it's working. We still needed birds breeding. And that's why in 1981, on the 4th of July, when we saw the first puffin flying in with fish, that's the clue we were looking for. Finally, we had success at Egg Rock.
Flying in with fish to?
Feed its chick. They fly in with fish, and then they drop under the rocks, and they come out without the fish. And that's the sign we were looking for. That meant there was a puffin chick under the rocks, the first puffin chick in nearly 100 years.
Steve, a number of people have emulated the techniques you developed in the Puffin Project. There are a number of bird restoration projects around the world. And in your own book, you wrestle with the question of sustainability. you say that people ask you, well, how sustainable is this? And your answer is, well, that's maybe not the right question. So what is the right question and what's the right answer?
Project Puffin is showing that if you just don't do this kind of work, these species are not going to come back. To stop this kind of work, they probably still will disappear. But they are still capable of living in this environment with a helping hand. When I was a young man, one of my mentors, Duryea Morton, pointed out to me that people are the only species that can make other animals go extinct. People therefore have the opportunity, perhaps even an obligation, to be the only species that can help sustain life on Earth. Because if we stop, these species that have been affected by humans will disappear. We live in a time of extinction, and without active intervention, we can be sure that we will lose species. And if we do, future generations will not have the opportunity to do the restoration that we have today.
Steve Kress and Derek Jackson are co-authors of the book Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. Steve, thanks for taking the time today.
My pleasure.